Chapter 12. We Forge Plans. Our clique of friends, the Chevrah, started meeting more often and devising plans. Our leader was my friend, Moshe Gellerman, who was somewhat older than I. He worked with a photographer, Karlovich. A girl from Warsaw, a Polish patriot, also worked there. She was touched by the fate of the Jews and wanted to help. Also, Moshe's cousin, Saul Ackerman, a refugee from Danzig, was then in Rodzin. He had connections with a Polish Navy officer who was expelled from Danzig and at that time was living in Bedlar, near Radzin. He and his wife were Polish patriots, friendly towards Jews, and active in the Polish underground. At about the same time, Ozier Ozerman, our friend from the town of Mydrzyjec, came to Radzin. He also was a member of the Hashomer Hatzair organization. He told us about a youth and resistance group which was being organized in Warsaw and in other cities, and he encouraged us to become active too. We were enthusiastic about his news, but due to problems of communication, our efforts were hardly serious. The land estate, Suchowola Manor, which was 15 kilometers away, and once belonged to the Polish prince and anti-Semite, Chetvertinsky, was confiscated. It was said that the Germans had offered him a position as a sort of collaborator, which he rejected, even though he had often organized pogroms against the Jews. The SS official Schultz took over the administration of the farm. Schultz soon became well known in the entire area for his terror and brutality. At the manor he built a camp in which he held Jews not only for work, but to satisfy his sadistic tendencies. The number of Jews in the camp at any time depended on his mood. It was a one-man business. For his guest appearances at local persecutions, Schultz always arrived on a horse. When he was in Radzin, the town belonged entirely to him. He killed, tortured, and enjoyed the fear he caused. Of course, he only rode to the places where Jews lived, and always on the sidewalk. Although everybody tried to hide, he always found victims. He seemed to sniff them out like a dog, no matter where they were. At first he beat them, then he either let them go or took them along, depending on his mood. His brutal appearance was in keeping with his work. He looked like the incarnation of a police criminal record. My best friend, Sholke Gellerman, with whom I'd grown up, became the victim of Schultz's caprice and was taken to the Jewish slave camp at Suchowola. To his own surprise, Sholke Gellerman found favor with Schultz and was named elder of the camp. Considering the situation, Sholke enjoyed a relatively good life there. At least he was safe from other persecutions and deportations. Soon Sholke had his brother join him, and together they became the managers of Schultz's camp in Suchowola. Shortly thereafter they brought their parents, friends, and relatives to the camp as well. Edel Turkeltaub, Edessa Turkeltaub, Rochelle Nussbaum, Moshe Kaschemacher, Yachiel Leuchter, and Tova Elfenbaum, and many more were among those who found temporarily in Suchowola protection through the Gellermans. They worked in the fields, had enough to eat, and felt secure as so-called useful Jews. Under the pretext of needing something from the town, the Gellerman brothers came to Radzin almost every Sunday. The Chevrah met with them at that time, usually at the Kamienczynskis or at my home, to discuss the situation. Together we came to the conclusion that we had no chance of surviving in Radzin. We agreed that we did not want to die like our fellow sufferers had before us. We talked about the heroes of our past, Bar Kochba and the Maccabees, and we dreamed of saving our people's honor. We were ashamed of the present. Through the Gellermans and Suchowola, we had more possibilities in Radzin than ever before. We even had some weapons, although hardly anyone knew how to use them. A friend of ours from Warsaw, who had connections there, played an important part in our plans. We knew that there were several groups in the country with the will to survive, but meeting and organizing was almost impossible. Nevertheless, we had to make a start. Thanks to some friends, we established connections with the Polish underground. Through our friend in Warsaw, whose name I have unfortunately forgotten, we maintained contact with the Hashomer Hatzair headquarters in Warsaw. In view of our hopeless situation and our limited possibilities, we decided to procure forged Aryan papers, move to Warsaw, and disappear in the big city. It did not take long before the Aryan papers, including birth and work certificates, were ready and waiting for us in Suchowola. Our Polish girl photographer, who had worked with Moshe at Karlovich's, was given our trust, and she played an important part in the operation. She offered us her mother's apartment in Warsaw as a first contact address. The wife of the Polish naval officer from Danzig was willing to accompany us, two at a time, to Warsaw. There we were to live outside of the ghetto with Polish families from the underground. Of course, all expenses were to be paid by us. Hence, we decided to sell everything that we could not carry with us and convert to cash and valuables. We were 12 people, young boys and girls, who happened to come together as a chevrah, but there were many more people waiting for such an opportunity of fleeing. For reasons of security, no team of two was to know the address of the others. Only Moshko and his Warsaw friend would know all the addresses and establish lines of communication among the different groups. We really believed that we would be able to hide among the masses in Warsaw. It also was a good feeling simply not to die on orders of the SS. We were quite enthusiastic about joining the resistance and working with the underground. Today I realize that it was a childish and naive idea to go to Warsaw. And at the same time, many people from Warsaw saw their only chance was in the provinces. Today I also know that several hundred Jews hid and survived in the dense forest near Pachev, which was only 40 to 60 kilometers from Radzin. The elder of the Jews, Lichtenstein, owned one of the town's most beautiful houses. When the Germans marched in, they confiscated his house and used it for the more prominent members of the occupation forces. The city council lived in that house, as well as Buchner and Mr. Möbius, both from Dresden and other Gestapo families. One day it caught fire and was badly damaged. Lichtenstein immediately arranged to have 40 to 50 Jewish specialists start rebuilding the house. Since the restoration was in the Germans' interest, Lichtenstein thought he could therefore save 50 more people as useful Jews. It was another opportunity to combine usefulness with practicality. The Germans agreed. They did not have to pay the workers anyway. They rewarded these Jews by prolonging their lives, at least for the necessary working period, thereby excluding them from the lists of those bound for Treblinka, if only temporarily. I too went to work on the reconstruction of Lichtenstein's burned house, and in other German offices as well. But the important thing was that I kept myself under the wing of Simon Lichtenstein, the son of the elder of the Jews. My sister and brother-in-law, who lived together with us in a tiny apartment, worked for a German company, Overbeck, from Bremen. The company sold household goods and machines in exchange for coupons, for which the farmers had to deliver grain. Due to their work with this company, my sister and brother-in-law received adequate food, and most important, they felt safe in their role as truly useful Jews. The German employer from Bremen confirmed this belief. When the moment came, however, everything proved to be an illusion. The gentleman from Bremen let my brother-in-law and my sister down.